summer pledge drive. Donations can also be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And up next is What's at Stake with your host, Verna Avery Brown. You are in tune to WPFW, Washington.
Vice President Kamala Harris is running for president. The pros and cons of her candidacy, and the chilling promise Trump made to his base that's going slightly under the radar. Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, the announcement yesterday that the little-known Minnesota Governor Tim Walz will be joining Vice President Kamala Harris on the campaign trail as her vice presidential candidate pumped another $20 million into the Harris-Walz coffers. Apparently, somebody knows Walz, and they like him. In July, when President Biden suspended his candidacy for the presidency and handed the torch to Vice President Kamala Harris, it felt like we were watching a long-distance race in the Olympics when a strong-distance runner grabs the baton and changes the whole rhythm of the race. There's a surge of excitement that goes through those on certain teams and anticipation that your team now can finally win the race. Well, it's too early to tell what impact Walz will have and whether he'll help carry Harris over the finish line in November, but the excitement and exuberance at yesterday's rally reportedly had Trump seething, according to some anti-Trump Republicans. Just to review where we are, hundreds of thousands of Democrats are feeling that surge. Over 40,000 Black women logged onto a call the Sunday night the announcement was made and raised over $1 million to Black, or rather to back the vice president. Then thousands of Black men had a call and raised over $1 million. Then white women, then white men, then LGBTQ plus individuals. And Netflix executive chairman Reed Hastings donated $7 million to the Harris campaign. And according to the New York Times, the Harris-Walz campaign said it now has $377 million in its war chest, in contrast to the $327 million that the Trump campaign has said it has. While both campaigns have impressive hauls, in the end, and the final analysis is not how much money you spent, but how many voters are engaged enough to go to the polls on Tuesday, November 5th. There'll, of course, be two tallies, taking the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. A candidate can win the popular vote but lose the election if he or she doesn't have the 270 Electoral College votes. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but failed to garner 270 Electoral College votes, making Donald Trump the winner in 2016. But in 2020, Trump fell short of Electoral College votes by 74, and he allegedly engaged in a fake elector scheme, pushing Republicans in states like Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia to put forward an alternate slate of electors. This morning in this segment of What's at Stake, a kind of Albright or Soros Equality Voters Matter Fund, which builds community and organizational capacity related to Black voting power. BVM, as it's called, received national attention in 2017 when they helped mobilize Black voters during the U.S. Senate race between Doug Jones and Roy Moore. Since then, Cliff and the BVM team have traveled throughout 13 primarily southern states in the blackest bus in America, energizing voters and exposing voter suppression. He and his team recently played a critical role in the 2020 election cycle, including the historic Georgia runoff elections for U.S. Senate. Good morning, Cliff Albright, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. Well, Cliff, all right, you have worked closely on several elections, both state and national, in Georgia and Alabama and throughout the rest of the country. And how would you characterize this election in comparison to other elections in the history of the U.S.?
I hate sometimes I hate answering that question and saying this, you know, when we're speaking out in public, because, you know, it's become routine where every election cycle, you know, our folks are told, oh, this is the most important election of our lifetimes, right? But unfortunately, we've got to really say this is the most important election of our lifetime. But there are some very real reasons, right, why this is the case, why this is not just any other election, why there are things that are at stake or at play in this election that, in all honesty, we've never seen before, right? We've never seen before an election involving a candidate who previously, as president, really refused to give up power, right? So we've never seen that dynamic before. This is the first presidential election, the only presidential election that's taking place after there was an actual insurrection attempt that invaded the U.S. Capitol. We've never seen that before, like just historically. It's unprecedented, right? You know, we've never had a candidate who has said that he would become a dictator on day one. Like, you know, we've never seen that before. And so when we say that this is the most important election, and that this could be an election that determines whether or not there are any future elections, that's not hyperbole. Like, there are some very concrete and very specific things that distinguish this election cycle, this presidential election cycle, from any that we've seen before. And especially, you know, as a Black community, as an organization that largely focuses on building power in Black communities, there's some issues at stake and some potential policies at stake that really represent a clear and present danger to our community.
And we can't overlook the fact that this is this could very well lead to the presidency of the first female woman of color. That's a very real dynamic. Yeah. So are you surprised by the groundswell of support for 360,000, what I understand?
Yeah, only to the extent, and not that it's not deserving, right? Happened so quickly. Right. I mean, it's really been something like people are making comparisons to the Obama years in 2008. And that was a buildup. Right. Like there was a buildup in that campaign, one in which Black voters were very skeptical at first. We were looking at Iowa and New Hampshire like, are y'all really going to vote for the Black guy? You know, and it built up over time until you got to the Southern primaries. And then even during the primaries, it built up. But I mean, this was literally like overnight, not even overnight. It was like at one point in the day, you know, President Biden made his announcement, you know, which I think we got to give credit for is an historic announcement, is an historic move for somebody to voluntarily or at least somewhat voluntarily, right, to drop out of the race. But, you know, within hours of him doing so, you saw the wave of support for Vice President Harris. You saw these calls being organized and you went through the list. And as you said, the first one being the Women with Black Women, right? And in a matter of hours, they were able to get the word out to get 44,000 women on that call. None of the other groups were able to do it that quickly, but that inspired all of these other groups to then turn around. And as you said, you start seeing the Black men and the LGBT community and then white dudes and white women and all of that. And so for it to have happened so quickly and the depth of it and the amount of energy, I was at the Atlanta rally, you know, not from a partisan perspective, just as a, you know, somebody who does this work and was at the Kamala Harris rally in Atlanta. And I got to tell you, the energy there was real. Like the energy that we saw yesterday in the rally where she unveiled Tim Walz as his, as her running mate. That's real. And so that's the surprising part, is that it's happened so quickly and that it's such a high level of energy.
So now, Cliff, you're in Georgia, and Georgia has historically been a red state, but it turned blue in 2020. And it's one of seven swing states. And I understand the Harris-Walz campaign is going to swing through Georgia shortly at some point in the near future. It has 16 electoral college votes up for grabs. Georgia proved to be critical to Biden's victory. Do you have an early read on how voters are leaning in Georgia for this Harris waltz? Waltz is so bright, isn't it?
And I should say we're doing our work in Georgia, but you know, we do work all across the country. But certainly with what's happening in communities, we do work and have local partners in over 75 counties across the state of Georgia. So not even just in the metro Atlanta area, in rural Georgia, middle Georgia, southwest Georgia, all of that. And so, we've said from the beginning, we've been saying all year, even as there were people that were trying to say, well, Georgia's no longer at play. And, you know, there's not a down ballot race, a state race that can, you know, really pull people out. Stacey Abrams not on the ballot. There's no Senate race like with Warnock in 22 that's on the ballot. You know, and so some people were saying, including Democratic insiders, saying, well, Georgia's not in play. So all year we've been saying that it was. And if you didn't believe it when we were saying it months ago, you best believe it now. Because, you know, all the polls are showing that Kamala Harris is running like 8 points stronger with black voters than President Biden was. And she's also running stronger with other demographics in the state, but, you know, particularly with black voters. And that jump alone, that jump within, you know, black energy and black support immediately takes this from a race where, you know, some people were saying that Biden was down by, you know, 4 points or something like that, 4 or 5 points. But it immediately has now made it, at a minimum, has now made it a dead heat. And I would argue that, you know, that it's really that those polls are underestimating the amount of support for Kamala Harris. And keep in mind, this wave has happened. They haven't even gotten to the DNC yet. Even gotten the bump that you get at your convention. So this is, again, it's a very real energy. It's a very real trend in Georgia and elsewhere, but in Georgia in particular,
Let me ask you about Georgia, Cliff Albright, co-founder of Black Voters Matter. Can a candidate win the state of Georgia with black votes alone? And what is the equation necessary for a candidate to carry Georgia?
Yeah, no, I mean, of course you can't win the state of Georgia with black votes alone. It takes a coalition, right? It takes the same kind of coalition that we saw in 20, the same coalition that we saw in 22. And I should say 21, because technically the Senate runoffs took place in January of 21. But it takes a coalition, right? It takes winning at least 85, 88, you know, preferably 90% of the black vote. And then, you know, you've got to be able to get that 25 or so percent of the white vote. And then you got other populations here. They're like, you know, people underestimate the Latinx vote here in Georgia. The AAPI vote, actually, in 20, while it was by no means the largest segment of the electorate, they actually had the largest increase in their turnout from the previous cycle to that cycle. And so and of course, young voters, right? And so it takes a coalition to get that kind of victory that we've seen in 22.
So now there's tremendous support for Vice President Harris among black women and women of color, but it's been suggested that black men aren't as enthusiastic about her candidacy. I know there's the call with the $1 million raised, but there's still a little whisper undercurrent camp, you know, in the community that some black men are not really feeling her. So have you encountered that sentiment at all in the organizing work that you're doing?
In all honesty, no more than we ever feel in any other election, right? You know, there's been a lot said in the media and polling, some of which was really bad polling, about this so-called shift taking place. But, you know, that doesn't match what we've seen in our conversations in communities. It doesn't match what we've seen in terms of actual election results. Keep in mind, there were people saying that Herschel Walker was going to get 30%, 25% of black men, because certainly all black men are going to vote for the guy that used to run around with the football and that won a Heisman Trophy. And at the end of the day, Herschel got like two votes from black men. And so, So, you know, this notion and this narrative that's out there simply hasn't proven to be true. Now, does that mean that there aren't black men that, you know, have felt like they haven't been listened to, that they haven't been targeted for conversations, or that there aren't some policies that they disagree with coming out of Democrats writ large or this presidential administration? Of course not. I mean, there's always that level of critique within our community. There's always, I mean, even under Obama, you still had 10%, you know, that didn't vote for Obama. So you've always got that. Is there a massive shift taking place? No, not at all. That doesn't mean that there isn't space for improvement in messaging. And to be honest, I've seen improvements in messaging and in outreach, particularly coming out of the vice president's office.
So now, while there's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for the vice president, there are also some very hardcore, passionate anti-Harris individuals in the black community. We see them on these TikToks and whatnot. Yeah. I don't know if you will be out actually knocking on doors, Cliff, but how will the Harris volunteers respond when they're confronted with oppositions for the, for example, she's not black, Kamala is not black, and it's dumb to vote for her just because she's black. She's not qualified. What's the response? Are you training or preparing your door knockers for on that kind of?
You know, you hear the she's not black, which is really ignorant, right? I don't know. I don't know historically how you make that argument, or even from her personal experience of attending a HBCU, of pledging the first black sorority, right? And so I don't, I don't know how you come to that conclusion. And it's really just, it's a Trump talking point that I don't think is going to go so far. Again, you're always going to have, some black folks that repeat these talking points, or some folks pretending to be black, because there's actually been a lot of exposure around the disinformation, fake accounts. You've seen examples of people posting these things. I'm black and I'm not for her, but they did it forgetting to change their actual account. So instead of doing it from their fake black account, they actually did it from their real life account. And everybody's you forgot to switch over.
Busted.
right. You've been busted, So some of it is coming from fake, fake accounts and fake black people. And then it gets picked up by some people. So that one, I don't think is going to go very far. I think the other one that they're going to try to do is the same things what they did in 2019 in terms of, attacking her blackness by attacking her role as being a district attorney. But interestingly enough, what we are seeing this cycle, which we really didn't see as much in 2019, in 2019, a lot of people took some of those attacks and some of that disinformation at face value, right? Thinking, oh, she was a DA, so she must have locked up people for these marijuana possessions. This year, what you're seeing is more people taking a closer look and saying, wait a minute, the data says that's not true, right? The data says that, no, in fact, she did not lock up people for marijuana possession charges.
She didn't put over 1,500 marijuana violators in jail and kept people in prison beyond their sentence date. How about that criticism?
No, and that's what people are finding out. People are mixing up, arrests taking place when she was DA versus during her time as an attorney general. And so, attorney generals aren't arresting people for marijuana possession charges, right? DAs are. So people were looking at some of the numbers for when she was AG and saying, oh, look what happened while you were AG. Well, that has nothing, literally absolutely nothing to do with her. But when you looked at her time as DA, what you saw is that there were no arrests for that. And in fact, the only convictions for possession were in cases that were actually higher level charges that got pled down specifically because they had a position that said they weren't trying to, incarcerate people for marijuana related charges, even for the dealing. And so the dealing and sales would get pled down to possession. But if you were arrested and charged actually with possession, that was not prosecuted. And then when you look at people are finding out now about, you know, this diversionary program that she had, I can't remember, second step.
It's Back on Track.
Back on Track. Thank
back
you.
On Track.
Thank you.
The reentry court records.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Records exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. And so she had a whole program, and so she had policies, including policies around sex workers, where she would not prosecute, you know, young girls that were involved in sex work, and to the point where the police department evidently was mad at her. But as a matter of policy, she refused because she saw them as being, you know, victims in a system, and refused to arrest. So what we are finding out now is that in 2008, or in this period of time, she actually had, and keep in mind, this is 6 years before Black Lives Matter, 6 years before Michael Brown, 6 years before like the real launch of Black Lives Matter, 8 or 10 or even 12 years before this notion of progressive DAs really started to enter our vocabulary. Mm-hmm. But if you look at her period of time, she was doing some things then that actually now we do look at as being policies of what it means to be a progressive DA. Mm-hmm. None of that really got a look in 2019, but people are looking at that now.
And what about the allegation that she kept people in prison beyond their sentence date?
No. And again, that's one of those articles and stories that came out that didn't get a lot of real close scrutiny. But when you look at it, what the article was basically saying was that she was doing, she was under investigation for these things, right? And her office was holding people. And at the end of the day, what we all know is the attorney general doesn't release people from the correction system, right? There's an entire correction system, including a corrections, you know, depending on the state that you're in, it might be a cabinet level position. But that's another function of the executive administration. What the attorney general's job is to argue legally for the governor and for other state agencies, right? And that's what her role was. But the agency that was under investigation, including an investigation that started before she was even AG, had nothing to do with her office, but her office was tasked with having to make, you know, the legal arguments in the various court cases. But the office that was in charge of who got released and when they got released and all of that had nothing to do with her. But it's easy to conflate, you know, it's the state doing this and it's the attorney general that shows up. You know, it's similar to arguing that the U.S. Solicitor General, who argues on behalf of the president's administration at the Supreme Court, that the Solicitor General is the one who is doing whatever it is that whatever U.S. department is being accused of, rather than correctly saying, well, no, it's the Solicitor General's job, like by definition, to have to argue and defend in court, much, you know, similar to the way that the public defender, you know, would have to argue. The public defender's not on trial for, you know, the robbery, but they are the ones that are tasked with defending it. And so it's similar to that situation.
So, Cliff, I would imagine you've got your work cut out for you with this campaign. And have you detected, and this will be my final question, I know you've got a few minutes more with us, have you detected any voter suppression tactics being enforced or implemented?
Yeah, the question is where have we not seen voter suppression tactics, you know? And I think that and that's what we got to keep in mind. There's a lot of discussion around the energy that people are seeing and how people are now more motivated to go vote. And that's all well and good. But what we've got to keep in mind is that Black turnout in this country has never just been a function of how motivated we are or how much we want to vote. Right. We didn't have large voting numbers from 1877 until 1965, not because we weren't motivated, right? We didn't have turnout because we weren't able to turn out because, you know, you had a Jim Crow and a voter suppression framework that did not allow us to vote, you know, counting jelly beans and literacy tests and all that. We don't have to go into that whole history. But the point is that our voting practices in this country have never just been a function of whether or not we want to vote or whether or not we're motivated to vote or how energized we are. And this is no different. And so this energy that we're seeing may have us wanting to vote and intending to vote, but we've seen ongoing voter suppression, you know, that reach high levels after the 2020 election and wave of voter suppression bills that we saw in 2021, but it didn't stop in 21. It went on in 22, 23, and even this year. And so I'll just give you one example right here in Georgia. Just this week, the state election board just recently changed the rules and the policies around how to certify elections, right? Mm. This is a newly developed state election board, which was changed in the voter suppression bills, and it was changed specifically for this reason, because they now have greater control over the way that the various counties and the state certify elections. So what Georgia's voter suppression bill did was exactly what Trump wanted them to do, which was go out and find me 11,700 votes. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the power to do it in 2020. But guess what? Because of the bill that was passed after the fact, they now have the power to basically do what he was asking them to do. To
go out and find votes?
Go out and find votes, or more importantly, go out and don't count these votes. And they don't have to do that in the largest county. They don't have to do that in Atlanta and Fulton County. They can pick off a couple of smaller counties and achieve the same purpose. They now have set themselves up to be able to do that. And so it's those changes. Yes, all of the other changes are bad. The changes around food and water and not being able to give out food and water and the long lines that are created by the state, right? You know, closing down polling places, getting rid of drop boxes, making it harder to vote by absentee mail. Again, in Georgia, they just put up a website that now lets you go online to cancel somebody's voter registration. All you need is their name and date of birth and last four of their social, and you can cancel it online pretending like you're that person, right? They've made it easier to do things like this. And so from every step of the process, from registration to absentee to early voting to same day, election day voting to certification, every step of the process has been made more difficult. And that's what our ongoing concern is. And that's why we need the federal legislation that we've been arguing for years now, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, as well as the Freedom to Vote Act.
Cliff Albright, political economist, speaker, and activist, executive director of Black Voters Matter and Black Voters Matter Capacity Building Institute. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake. Now, most white Americans who regularly attend worship services voted for Trump in 2020, but Black churchgoers, well, not so much. They voted for Biden. And Trump is desperate to maintain those white evangelical votes. And he made a chilling promise to them that is, well, downright scary. The Reverend Dr. Liz Steele Harris joins us, helps us unpack this issue when we come back. Back in a moment. Stay with us.
Oh, yeah. Hey, friends, we are back again. Mark your calendars. On Saturday, August the 24th, WPFW will host the 15th annual Blues Festival featuring Clarence the Blues Man Turner, Jim Bennett with Jesse Terrell, Stacy Brooks, Low Rent Quartet, Reggie Wright, Diamond Complex, 4400 Livingston Road in Indian Head, Maryland. Event time is from 12 p.m. Eventbrite.com and search WPFW. Why, you ask? Because WPFW is building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Believe that.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. While speaking to a group of mostly white conservative Christians, former President Donald Trump told the guy, got to get out and vote. In 4 years, you don't have to vote again. November 5th. After that, you don't have to worry about voting anymore. I don't care, because we're going to fix it. The country will be fixed, and we won't even need your vote anymore, because frankly, we will have such love. If you don't want to vote anymore, that's okay. End of quote. The Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris is a theologian, pastor, author, and anti-poverty activist. She's the executive director of the Cairo Center for Religious Rights and Social Justice and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, the National Call for Moral Revival. Good morning, Dr. Theo Harris, Reverend Dr. Theo Harris.
Good morning. It's so great to be with you. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks for being with us. What was your reaction when you heard Trump had made that statement?
Well, just like a number of the statements that have been made in the last weeks and months, they're starting to say, you know, the quiet part out loud. Some of their intentions, these extremists, especially these white Christian nationalists, where they're starting to talk about, you know, the wholesale takeover of the country that they're plotting and planning. And I think it's not an accident that this happens amongst some of the very people who have funded and supported many of the policies and politicians that are in power right now, whether it's the fact that, you know, for the first time in history, although we've had Christian nationalism and extremism powerful in this country since its founding, really, we have Mike Johnson, you know, the third ranking politician in the country, who is a self-professed Christian nationalist. And we have, all of this Project 2025, even as Trump, you know, distances himself from it, can't really find much space between him and this kind of Heritage Foundation policy platform. And you surely can't find any distance between J.D. Vance and it. And this is what it's set up to do. This is the intention, you know, this kind of wholesale capture of the state is this ultimate goal of this, the kind of Christian nationalist architects of mm-hmm. Project 2025 and others that are behind the election right now.
So is it possible, in what legal possible scenario could Trump be referring to where voters would not have to vote again? I mean, well, is it possible we're in this?
I mean, of course, that is what is being said right now. But if you read Project 2025, you know, it's a 900-page document from the Heritage Foundation. And it's a very clear plan about how they're going to implement their drive to power, right? You know, there's all these different sections. One is about taking the reins of government, quote unquote, right? And it's about centralizing executive authority in the office. There's sections on securing the common defense. You know, their way of doing that is going to be to expand every branch of the military. The longest section in the whole 900-page document is about general welfare. And as an anti-poverty activist, I have a lot of interest in that. And, you know, it shouldn't be any surprise that the Departments of Agriculture, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development are all subject to, you know, deeply significant cuts and cutbacks. And, you know, and it kind of goes on from there. And so, I mean, this is a playbook about what's supposed to happen if are elected or are able to kind of rig the election to be in power and the impact that it will have on democracy, but also on public education, any kind of regulations of the food that we're going to eat, inclusive and gender inclusive care. You know, all of this is up. It's not to scare people, but it's to have us informed that folk are organized and have a plan.
You said regulation of the type of food that we're going to eat. I mean, that's really the first time I heard that.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I mean, the idea that kind of the FDA will basically be completely defunded, and that there won't be the kinds of regulations on the food or the drugs that we consume. You know, that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, will be undone. And, you know, the fossil fuel companies and other environmental polluters will be able to, you know, have free rein. And the kind of, you know, impact that will have on the food we're eating as well as on the environment mm-hmm. we're living in. The kind of undoing of Medicare and Social Security and any kind of protections and social safety nets, you know, including, you know, housing and SNAP and Medicaid and Head Start, right? I mean, the idea is in that plan straight up is to eliminate Head Start, right? And the 39 million kids that have benefited from that, you know, will be out of luck. But it's all connected, right? You know, this kind of trying to consolidate power and subvert democracy is connected to a military budget, is connected to, you know, abandoning the people, especially poor and low income people, and seeing the connections between, you know, attacking democracy and other social, economic, and racial justice issues.
Mm. So according to an article in the New York Times, Trump was given a chance to retract his statement that they would never have to vote again in an interview with Fox News host Laura Ingraham. Instead, he repeated his assertion that Christians will never have to vote again if they vote for him in November. So is it your belief, Reverend Dr. Theo Harris, that he was leaning, he's assuming that this Project 2025 would be in place and all those regulations and restrictions and policy changes that are outlined in that blueprint would be in effect, and therefore the country would be quote unquote fixed. They will fix it.
I mean, I think one of the things that we have to really pay attention to in this election year is that when Donald Trump went into office in 2016, many folk, including folk that were supporting him, were pretty surprised. But if Donald Trump is able to make it into the office in 2024, there are highly organized and very strategic forces from business to kind of the election that have a plan. And we saw already the impact on the Supreme Court, on the different judges, on the legislation that was passed, you know, when he was in office the first time. And from whether it's Project 2025, to you know, other blueprints that folk have been working on, it seems very clear that the Christian nationalists that are behind this, you know, are gunning for power, and they indeed
somehow
what.
Okay. So let me ask you this, Reverend Dr. Theo Harris. How is it that white evangelicals find Trump so appealing as a candidate when he's A, not a Christian, B, I don't think he attends church. I'm not sure. I've never seen any reports or pictures of him doing so. He's a convicted felon for his relationship with a porn star. He admits he assaults women and can't even quote one Bible verse when pressed by a reporter to do so. Is it just the abortion issue, or What's the appeal here?
So I think that this is a really important question. And I think that it shows us how clear and true Christian nationalism and white Christian nationalism are as a political movement and not just a kind of a religious position or ideology. And, you know, in kind of the tenets of Christian nationalism, you know, you have this exclusionary and regressive form of Christianity as a kind of the only true religion. You have kind of patriarchy and heteronormativity as this kind of natural order. And so therefore things like abortion, things like banning all, you know, gender inclusive care, you know, become front and center, and whoever's going to push that is who gets the support. You know, there's this kind of militarism and violence as kind of the way to exert power. And this should remind us of actually something like the Pax Romana when Jesus walked the earth, where, you know, the those in power that he opposed, you know, were preaching peace. But the way that they were kind of enforcing that peace was through militarism. And then there's, you know, kind of the economic reality of life. I think it's really important for us to see that many of the biggest supporters of Donald Trump are not poor and low income people. It's business and the wealthy who have been benefiting greatly from his, you know, tax cuts and other kind of policies of giving more money and more power to the very wealthy, and in fact punishing the poor. I think a key feature of this kind of Christian nationalism is doing things like criminalizing the unhoused and actually you know, all forms of kind of anti-poor policies. And then I think, you know, what we've seen is that in some of what Trump was able to deliver, whether it's through the Supreme Court picks or other judges or policies, you've had all kinds of powerful Christian leaders, Christian nationalist leaders, including folks like Mike Johnson, who you know, really give props to Donald Trump for all of the things that he's been able to do to have that movement, you know, accomplish some of its goals. And so I think when we think about this just as what people of faith think, I think we aren't seeing that Christian nationalism and white Christian nationalism are in fact this kind of political force to be dealt with, and a political movement. And just like many of the leaders of the moral majority and other kind of, you know, Christian quote unquote right folk, you know, were willing to take up abortion when that wasn't the issue, but actually as a way to counter their desire to block the desegregation of Christian schools. But they couldn't, you know, say that quiet part out loud. And so they all organized around abortion and were able to win kind of a base of support around that issue and of making that as one of the only moral issues of our day, when in fact, actually, you know, I believe we really have to be putting out these other issues that are of great concern to people of faith, and would be ways for us to win more and more Christian leaders and leaders from all faiths over to more just policies.
Leaders of all faiths. Because one of the things in that Project 2025, I think, seeks to make classrooms for American children more like a Christian enclave. And you have to wonder, what about the Muslims, the Jews, the atheists, you know, why should they have to be subjected to that? Well, let me just say, So former President Trump has denied knowing anything about this extremely radical Project 2025 prepared by the Conservative Heritage Foundation. Yet over 50% of his former staffers and allies have allegedly contributed to the project. And just recently, it was exposed that Trump's vice presidential pick in a soon-to-be-released book by Kevin Roberts, who is the leader of Project 2025, Vance endorses fundamentally Christian view of culture and economics, unquote. So, Reverend Dr. Theo Harris, how do you interpret the views and strategies being promoted in Project 2025 by Kevin Roberts? Are they fundamentally economics?
No, they are not. Thank you for that question, because there are 2,000 passages across the Bible that speak about justice for the poor, and never say a word about cutting families off of food support. You know, Jesus travels around the countryside, setting up free healthcare clinics, never charging a leper a copay, right? And yet, in here, there's all these cuts to Medicaid and Medicare. When Jesus, you know, comes out in his inaugural sermon, and he talks about the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, God has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, to those made poor by policy. That's what's good news to the poor, except for the ending of poverty. And yet, if you look at all of those provisions about the general welfare and everything in Project 2025, there couldn't really be something less Christian than what's in what's in those 900 pages. And it just continues, you know, whether it's about, you know, freedom of expression, whether it's about gender affirming care, whether it's about a woman's right to choose. You know, when Jesus walked the earth, there were people having abortions. They were poor people and they were wealthy people. If Jesus cared, he would have said something. What he did say something about was, if there's anyone that asks of you, you should give to them. If there are people that are hungry, you should feed them. You know, when you don't visit those in prison, that's where you're not visiting me, right? I mean, there is a clearly economic and social and justice core to our Christian teachings and scriptures. They really could not be farther from what's contained in Project 2025. You have these Christian nationalists who call themselves Christian, but who seem to be pledging more of an allegiance to power and to their power, which is exactly the kind of critique that Jesus had of the ruling authorities of his time.
And so you have to wonder, how is it that white evangelicals and Black Christians are so far apart on the teachings of the Bible?
Well, it's a really important point. I think for 50 years now, many white Christians and folks in more white churches and denominations have been conceding the Bible and its interpretation to this small group of extremists, when there's actually a deep prophetic tradition that has continued in many Black churches and amongst many Black Christians and others, including I would say there are white Christians out there who also believe in this prophetic mandate that comes in the Bible, but who's been organized and who's been vocal amongst white Christians and especially white evangelicals are extremists, and they've been able to capture many radio programs. They've been able to organize their way into many seminaries and denominations. They've been able to convince the media in many forms that there's an equal sign between extremism and Christianity when there should be an equal sign between Christianity and justice.
And do you believe that this statement on the part of former President Donald Trump has been given adequate media coverage, has been taken seriously enough?
Well, I not only do I not think it's been taken seriously enough, I don't think that the Christian nationalist kind of architects and backers and enablers of whether it was the January 6th insurrection or whether it's much of what Donald Trump has done. I don't think that there's been enough attention on the kind of Christian nationalist supporters of him. I think that when we hear these reports, even though we see that there are Christians throughout, there's not much time played and given to that. And I think it's to the detriment of us then having a powerful response about this kind of bad religion that's out there. Because for too long, in some communities, religion has been kind of looked over and conceded to extremists when I think that does not help the kind of justice organizing, movement organizing that many are trying to do. And I think there needs to be a clearer bridge between folks that are out there in the community raising these issues and organizing for justice and a kind of a moral vision for how that should happen in the world. A vision that is really different from the vision of Christian nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Is there a group or organization, in your opinion, that stands out that really needs to be scrutinized more carefully within that Christian nationalist movement?
I mean, there are definitely many different groups, and I think sometimes there's some attention paid for towards the, but I think there's a lot more scrutiny, in, especially about some of the Christian nationalist roots and connections, whether it's to the Heritage Foundation, whether it's to the folks that are around some of our Supreme Court justices, whether it's to Matt Flynn and other folks are trying to do with this kind of Take Back America organizing. But I think we should be paying more attention to the Christian nationalists behind many of the extremist policies out there.
Mm. And finally, Reverend Dr. Liz Deal Harris, is there a part of the Project 2025 that you find to be more frightening, more onerous than another, something that really needs to be sort of zeroed in on?
So to me, the fact that the longest section is focusing on kind of the general welfare. I think we need to be drawing more of an understanding and of culture war attacks and some of the kind of economic impacts, especially the anti-poor policies that they're putting forward. I think when we hear that the Supreme Court has criminalized the unhoused, or when we hear about various folks wanting work requirements for food stamps, I don't know that we always draw the connection to the mm-hmm. kind of conservatives, extremists, and Christian nationalists there. And they're all connected. And I think we would benefit from understanding that connection more okay. broadly.
The Reverend Dr. Liz Tiefer, an anti-poverty activist. She's the executive director of the Kairos Center for Religious Rights and Social Justice and co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning, Reverend Dr.
Thank you.
Harris. That concludes you listeners for joining us. And thanks to Noam Southampton and Anna G. Lara Lopez for production assistance in this morning's show. And thank you to our program director, Katia Stitt, sitting in today for our engineer, Michael Nasella. Be well, Michael. Stay tuned for Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams. I am Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of the late, great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done.
Doubt, they call it treason. We're chicken feathers all the way out.